This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn more about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hey there, welcome to the Feed, where we sit down with leaders and upstarts of the food media realm to discuss everything from navigating social media, building, engaging with, and growing a community, and producing content that resonates with young and old. I'm Jake Cohen, editorial director of the Feed, the world's largest crowdsourced food publication and social media community, serving as your daily source of what to cook, bake, and drink.
Today, we are joined by cookbook author, food blogger extraordinaire, longtime friend of Feed, Gabby Dalkin. Obviously, everyone knows you from What's Gabby Cooking. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Yes. So I really like, with all these conversations, I like to start from the very beginning because we've been obviously following you for years and have grown to love your kind of Cali vibes for all the recipes you develop, the photos you take. But what got you into food? Like, what did you study in college? What made you want to go to culinary school? Let's start from there.
Yeah, so growing up, I was actually probably one of the pickiest eaters I've ever encountered in my life. I only liked grilled cheese and like buttered noodles until I turned 19. And when I got to college, I was on the tennis team and I loved cooking for the team before matches. I only knew how to make one thing and that was chicken parm. Tyler Florence taught me back on Food Network 100 years ago when I was like watching it after high school and like, you know, doing my homework while I was watching. So I would make chicken parm for the team before every match. And I just loved having people around my table and feeding them and the camaraderie it brought. And so I was actually pre-med at the time. Like, I had no intention of going into the food world. And after college, I got a job. The whole company folded 6 months later. This was back in 2008. And instead of going to find another job, I thought I would go to culinary school, honestly, just for fun. Like, I just wanted to learn how to cook for myself. But at the same time I started school, I also started my blog as just a way to like show people I knew that I could cook. And I somehow finagled myself a job as a private chef, which is hysterical because I had no business being a private chef for anybody. And it just snowballed from there very slowly. But like I ended up just immersing myself in the food world and I never left.
So let's dive in a little deeper into what it was like as a private chef. Were you like, how many families? What was this like in this kind of first situation of cooking for others in a professional setting?
So I've only cooked for two families my entire career, one for the first 2.5 years and the other for the last 2 years. The first was a family in Malibu, a family of six. They had four kids. Everyone had very different taste preferences and dietary restrictions and all that kind of stuff. So I was essentially like a short order cook. And I had to cook like 9 things a night. And it was honestly the best training I could have asked for because I was in culinary school at the same time. I learned how to cook literally everything under the sun because they just had such incredible taste in food and they would travel all over the world and they had the most incredible hotels and restaurants and all this stuff. So I was like, oh, I have to live up to all that. So it was just, I threw myself in and did it. And then the second family I cooked for, you might have heard of her. I cooked for Jessica Simpson for a few years.
Oh my God.
And she is a dream. Like, I feel so fortunate that both of my clients throughout my private chef life were actually amazing people and their families were amazing and their community around them that came over for dinner parties was lovely. I know a lot of people who are private chefs who do not have that same experience and, there's just so many horror stories in that industry, but I feel so fortunate that both families were amazing and we vacationed together. And I, you know, when you're a private chef, you're part of their family, like you're in their kitchen and I just think the kitchen is the heart of the home. And so if you're spending 6 hours a day preparing lunch and dinner for these people and feeding the kids and feeding the parents and everything, that's a really, special place to work, I think.
What were the kind of go-tos? What were Jessica Simpson's favorite dishes?
Well, Jess was my favorite because she eats just like I eat. Like she's from Texas, so like she loves a Tex-Mex dish. Like we made a lot of like fajita salads and just fajitas, quesadillas, tacos, all that kind of stuff. We did that, 4 out of 5 days of the week. And then they're big entertainers. So they would have game day parties and all that. So the rest of the time we were doing like all the dips and the wings and all the like football, like anything you could imagine that was football related, we cooked because they threw so many viewing parties and Super Bowl parties and all that kind of stuff. They were the ultimate entertainers.
I love that. So one of my favorite things to ask is to talk through the kind of thought process and the decision of when content creators take something that's like a hobby or a part-time blog and make it their full-time gig. What was kind of your thought process of when you decided to take that plunge?
Sure. So I was private chefing and doing the blog at the same time from 2009 until 2013. Maybe it was late 2012. It doesn't matter. So Jess was getting ready to go film a TV show. My first book, Absolutely Avocados, was about to come out and we were going on this like mini condensed book tour. And I was like, if I'm ever gonna make a go of What's Gabi Cooking full time, this is it. Like I've been really frugal with my money. Like I've saved up. If this doesn't work, I can go back and get another job as a private chef. But like, I need to give myself a chance. And so I just jumped in head first, retired from the private chef world, and spent all my time and energy focusing on What's Gabi Cooking and building the website and building the brand. I hired this woman who is now my mentor to help me really put what I thought What's Gabi Cooking was into a cohesive package so I could sell that to brands and use it when I was a spokesperson and like have a message that was woven throughout all of my content. And I'm not gonna lie, the first 6 months were really scary. Like I was making a couple hundred dollars here or there off of a sponsored post. I had like 2 ads on my site, so maybe I'd make like $45 a month or something like that. But it slowly, slowly started to pick up and more brands were taking notice of me and I was going to all these different food conferences and speaking at them. And eventually it got to a place where I was like, okay, this is going to work. And I think the second I became uber confident in the business model is when things took off.
I love that. You obviously have become known for this bright Cali aesthetic. When I see one of your photos, I know it's yours. What was the process like in terms of photography and your background of it and styling and how that has evolved? When I look at even like my own personal feed of like the photos I posted at the very beginning when I like made an Instagram were garbage. Oh my God. But
yeah,
I think about what was the learning curve like for you?
So for the first 4 or 5 years of What's Gabi Cooking, I was doing everything on my own. I had zero overhead with the exception of the food. And as I started making a little bit of money, I had this conversation with my mentor and she was like, you're allowed to invest into your business. And I was like, oh, wow, what a concept. Like, who thought of that? And so I got myself a camera. I bought myself props. And then eventually I started working with two of my best friends, Matt Armendariz and Adam Pearson, who are like the dream team of food photographer, food stylist duo. They're actually also married and two of my very best friends. And together, the three of us created what the What's Gabi Cooking aesthetic was going to be so that when you saw a photo out in the wild or in a magazine or on Instagram, you were like, oh, that definitely looks like something from What's Gabi Cooking. And so the three of us work together now on all photography, food style, any sort of visual asset for What's Gabi Cooking, we work on together. Matt's the photographer, Adam's the food stylist. I do all the recipe development and creative direction. And like my brand, like it was delegating things is really hard for me because I'm a control freak, but working with them who I trust so like I just trust them with everything. It's been a game changer.
And what was that like in the sense of starting to really define your aesthetic, your voice, what recipes you were going to develop as you kind of were discussing about talking to your mentor of what's Gabi Cooking looking like as a brand? What was that?
Yeah, so it was all about being this approachable, everyday California girl. Like when Lori, my mentor, and I worked together, I word vomited to her for like weeks on end about what I thought what's Gabi Cooking was. And she took it all and very nicely like put into a little package and came back to me and was like, Gabi, you're the California girl. And I was like, well, duh, like it can't be that simple. And she was like, no, it is that simple. Like, this is what you do. This is what you eat and you breathe and you live. And so when I realized that I was this everyday California girl and nothing is unattainable, everything is approachable, and we're an inclusive community and I want to bring joy to people's lives, that was so key in me creating content that revolved around that idea. So everything I do, I think to myself, is this recipe on brand? How is it going to photograph? Are people going to relate to it? Are they going to want to cook it in their kitchen? Does it feel like a little piece of California when you're living in the middle of South Dakota? Everything ties back to being that California girl. So I can give a clear message across visuals, my voice, the books, everything.
So you mentioned, you just used a word that I love, which was community. And I would like to kind of discuss a little bit about what that was like for you in terms of building a digital community. And then we can go into like how you continue to keep them engaged. I know you do everything from like your weekly IG lives. I'd love to kind of dive in of what your community is like, what was it building it, and how you continue to keep things fresh.
Yeah, I think the first time I started really paying attention to my community is back in the Snapchat era, because I think I was one of the first people to get on Snapchat and do what essentially we all do on Instant Stories now, but I did it on Snapchat. And then at the end of every Friday, when my quote unquote Snapisode was over, I would spend 24 hours responding to comments, and there would just be thousands of people that were watching and having questions, and I would help them, and then they would send me photos of their recipes all throughout the weekend into the following week. And I was like, wow, like these people, they're people actually watching, like they're people doing what I'm telling them. And it was kind of eye-opening for me. And so I really started to nurture those relationships, and a lot of them have become like family. Like, there are people who, you know, I've been messaging with back, not on Snapchat. I mean, no one's on Snapchat anymore. Everyone's moved back to Insta Stories. But I know people tell me when they're pregnant before they tell their friends. Like, people, you know, I'm part of their lives because, like I said, when you're a private chef, you're in their kitchen. And I feel like this is my way of being in their kitchen without actually being there physically. And so the community, like, does that answer the question? Did I go totally off topic?
But I want more. Like, now obviously that is something that is so important at the very beginning. What is it like now, like hundreds of thousands of more followers, that many more DMs, comments? Yep. Like, what is your strategy behind that?
My strategy is to respond to every single person that messages me, because I want to give them just as much time as they're giving to me. So they responding to DMs on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and on the blog, comments and all that, takes a huge chunk of my day, and I do it myself. Like, I'm not interested in delegating that to an assistant or anything like that, because I feel like I'm the only one who can answer these questions about, you know, like about the recipe, but then about life. Like, I've talked about very personal things, you know, our fertility journey, our my relationship with Thomas, and I don't want someone, an assistant, being like, yeah, everything's great, XOXO. Like, I want to give people the right answers and what's working for me. So I respond to every single person, and I think that has been a huge differentiator for me in terms of growing my brand, because I think everyone knows I'm going to respond to them not immediately, but within a couple hours. So if they have a question about whatever, I'll get back to them before they actually have to make dinner.
I love that. So, I mean, it's very important. I think it's so crucial, no matter how large you get, to always be understanding that it's not this sentient being. You have to be truly putting in as much time into talking to people as you are into the content.
Yeah. And it's so funny. I feel like there's so many of my friends from high school and college who are like, oh my God, What's Gabby Cooking looks like so much fun. I'm going to start a blog. And then they realize how much work actually goes into creating content, editing content, pushing it out, responding to people. And they're like, oh no, this is a terrible idea. I quit.
It's true. I think one of the hardest things for people, I think it ties into the conversation about this being very much so like you as a Cali girl, and it's authentically Gabby. And it's so draining to be putting your whole kind of life into this work of not only the content that's an extension of you, but then this dialogue with the community. So if it isn't really 100% you, then it's just like the hardest job to kind of take on, because you're having to kind of put on a front. So I find that the people that are the most successful and are able to be as like plugged in and active with their communities are the ones that are just really authentically themselves.
Yeah, I think it's very easy for people to see through otherwise.
Yeah. Then I kind of want to, you talked about Snapchat. What has been kind of your thought process with social media as things have come and gone? What's kind of your approach to a new platform or expanding to different verticals like Twitter, Facebook?
Sure. I think it's really, I was not an early adapter of Instagram at all. Like, I was actually quite late to the game. And so I think learning from that, it pays to be an early adapter. And maybe you don't know exactly what your voice is on that platform yet, but like, just get in there and experiment with it and see what's happening. I also think that doesn't mean you have to be on every platform. Like, for example, I'm on TikTok and I'm a consumer of TikTok, but I haven't quite figured out how I want to create content on that platform yet. And I think you and I talked about this when we were in New York.
Yes. Oh my God. That was at the very beginning.
Yeah. But like, to me, I just think it's worth it to get your username, to get your feet wet and like see what's happening and then see if it works for you. Like, for me, I'm a terrible dancer. Like, I don't think I want to do TikTok dancing videos, but like, maybe I can think of something else. But that also, just because I'm on it doesn't mean I have to create content for it. I know my audience isn't on TikTok yet. Like, so if I'm going to do TikTok content, I would be creating a new audience, which is great. But it just depends how much time you have to invest in it, because like, it takes a lot to cultivate an audience on a new platform. So like, for me,
I know
you're a pro. So like, I'm focused so much on my Facebook group, my Instagram audience. I even love Twitter. And you know, meeting in real life, like real life events are very important to the What's Gabby Cooking brand. So TikTok might happen for us. It might not. My husband, on the other hand, is thriving at TikTok and some of his videos have millions of views. And I'm like, you're literally singing Frozen in an ice tub. Like, how
does
this happen?
What's his handle?
I think it's What's Thomas Eating, the same as his Instagram.
I love that. Oh my God. I'm going to do a deep dive. actually, that's kind of a perfect segue into What's Thomas Eating. I'd love to discuss this dynamic and what it's like. For example, like, when did he begin to get involved? What has kind of been that journey?
Sure. So Thomas has always been involved in some way, shape, or form. Like, he learned how to build websites in college. So he was always helping like moonlight as the tech end of What's Gabby Cooking back 10 years ago when we started. But he didn't come on full time until about a year ago. And a year previous to that, he was like, your Instagram is so freaking perfect. And you're a disaster a lot of the time in other life. Like, I think he just started What's Thomas Eating, his Instagram platform, as a very creative outlet to show the other side of What's Gabby Cooking and like how it's not always beautiful cheese boards and skillet baked gnocchi. And sometimes I'm eating grilled cheese with ketchup on the floor, like in my robe. Like, it's not always pretty. Yeah. And we never thought it would go anywhere. We never thought it would turn into anything. But Thomas has landed. Thomas had a huge sponsor deal last year with a giant financial company, and he's thriving. Like, he's loving it. He posts like once a week or something, and it's always making fun of me, or so it's just really comical.
And what is that kind of been in terms of the, not only that kind of working together with someone you love, but the dynamic of him now being in the situation of having to learn the other side of everything you've been working for, of that kind of like, I really hate the word influencer.
But I also
have been struggling to find out like what's the replacement word.
We talked about this in New York too. We have to find a different word.
We have to. But I always think that's really a fun situation. That's something that's happened to me because I do these videos where I cook with my husband, and he's someone who's very private, not very like active on social. Like he doesn't understand. Like, I had to walk him through how to like post a story for the first time. And that was like 2 months ago. But because we do these videos cooking together, like, he's occasionally gotten stopped and recognized in New York. And that's like a stretch, 'cause it's not like I'm getting crazy views, but I think it's always so interesting when someone is kind of part of this realm, even if adjacent, and slowly, because of what's Gabi Cooking as a brand is encompassing your whole life, naturally Thomas is part of that.
Right.
So that's only going to continue and expand, especially with like the fact that I think that's such a huge part of how people cook and how people eat, and their lives in the kitchen are very much entwined with their significant others, their families. So I love that type of content.
Thank you. Yeah, he's thriving. I mean, and Thomas can do different kinds of content than I can. Like, he's taken all these SOM classes online, so he talks a lot more about wine than I'm comfortable talking about. And I mean, he has noticed every time, before me, when we're at the grocery store, the farmer's markets before quarantine hit, like, he's just taking it in stride. And but as far as like the tech side goes of him getting into that kind of stuff, he's like the nerdiest tech guy in the world. So he's like, he just figures it all out on his own. Like, he's very, self-sustaining about that kind of stuff.
Love that. Very important. So let's talk a little bit about meal plans, which is something that I feel like that's such a huge part of your website and what people come to you for. When did that start? And I'd love to know if that, like, the connections between that and your life as a private chef, because I do think that the two kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. So the meal plan started probably 4 years ago. And honestly, it started as a way for me to repurpose old content, because I have 2,000 plus recipes on What's Gabi Cooking, and you only see maybe one or two of them a day. So I wanted to make something where I could resurface older recipes and bring them to the light of day again. And then about a year in, it turned into the most like successful piece of content on the website, because people are so hungry for what, like, they just want a plan. They just want to know what to do. So if I can offer that to them and think it through, like, how much, like, we're not going to do chicken all 5 nights. So like, let's do some chicken, some vegetarian, some pasta, some healthy, some decadent, and do that thought work for them and post it. It is a huge relief off their back, whether or not they follow it to a T or they just follow 2 or 3 or 4 nights of it, whatever. I think it's been really helpful for people to see how we meal plan. And it's been great. When I was a private chef, I would meal plan every week. I would send a menu in on Sundays. It would get approved, or they would ask for modifications. I'd resend it in, and then I would grocery shop every morning before I was a private chef. But we had a general plan. Of course, we always are able to deviate from that now or back then, because things come up. People used to come over for dinner. Stuff like that happens. But I think when you have a general plan for your for your food for the week. It makes you not as stressed out. It brings a little bit more like it just makes you feel more at ease when you're trying to figure out, you're like, oh, I know what's for dinner. Like, I don't have to like go look at websites for 2 hours and then eat at 9 p.m. Does that make sense?
Love it. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think that's something that's so, I mean, we have had the exact same effect with our audience in terms of our meal plans. And I think that that's something that still to this day, as people try to become more empowered in the kitchen, having that sort of structure is so key. Mm-hmm. And with that, we are going to take a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
So I now kind of want to go into your cookbooks. I just got your new beautiful cookbook, which we'll dive into. But I first want to talk about what it was like getting that first book deal. What was kind of your thought process, your approach, the proposal, and how was it like going through that process?
Yeah, so the first book came out, I think, in 2013, 2012, something about that. It was called Absolutely Avocados. And I remember being in New York back in like 2010. I was a private chef. I was there with Matt and Adam. They were shooting something for Food Network. And we went out to dinner with a group of people in the food industry, mostly bloggers at the time. This was when BlogHer was still around and stuff like that. And we were sitting at a table and I was sitting next to an editor and he was like, you know, I'm looking for the new pioneer woman. What would you write about it if you wrote a cookbook? And I very much jokingly said, avocados. Like, I was known on Twitter as the girl obsessed with avocados at the time. And I was totally kidding. I gave no thought to it whatsoever. But then he was like, oh, that's a great idea. And then a couple weeks later, he emailed me and he was like, I want to buy it. Like, you should get yourself an agent. And so I scrambled to get myself an agent. I signed the deal. It was, looking back at it, there were a lot of things in that deal that I didn't know better than to ask for. And so it was a huge learning experience for me. And I had like 5 followers on Twitter at the time. Like I was very tiny. And so the book was just like a cute little side project. I thought it was a huge deal, of course. And then it ended up selling okay. Like it wasn't going to be a bestseller or anything like that. But I think I didn't know what I was doing, to be totally honest, at the time. And so whatever, it came out, it was fine. And I remember, well, I should back up. When I signed that deal, I had emailed a bunch of different agents to see if anyone wanted to represent me. And there was one woman who I really wanted who told me no. She said, you're not ready for me. You haven't developed your voice yet or your brand. And I was like, okay, whatever. Like, I like avocados. I'm pretty sure I'm fine. And anyways, she passed on me and that was fine. And then 4 years later, I got an email from her and she was like, hey, I've been watching you and I think you're ready. Like, I think if you want to work together, I'm ready to work with you. And so I left my first literary agent. I signed with Janice and she changed my world because she was like, all right, we need to write a new proposal for your next book. And she tore it to pieces. Like, my first proposal was nothing. Like, I didn't even write one, really. I just was like, hey, like, let's do it. And it got bought. But with my second book and my third book, I had to really spend time writing a proposal and fleshing it out. And I hired someone to help me edit it, and we shot photos for it. And I spent so much time and money perfecting it that it was already such a different experience when we took that to market. And then also at that time, I knew I didn't want I didn't want an editor who really wanted to be my friend. I wanted an editor who was going to push me. I ended up finding someone who could do both, but that wasn't my experience with my first book.
I kind of want to go in a little deeper on that experience of the first book, just because I think it's so important for so many people who kind of work so hard just to get that first deal. And then oftentimes it isn't as magical as it seems, in the sense of like things with your first contract. We don't need to get into specifics, but were there any kind of like bigger...
We can get into specifics. I'm an open book. Here's what I didn't ask for. I didn't know. I didn't get any creative control about what the book looked like, which was very devastating to me as someone who's a visual person. Yes, I got to work with Matt and Adam on it, so I knew the photos were beautiful, but I didn't have any say on the cover, the layout, how big the book was going to be, the font. I got none of that, which was really hard. So I would say, if you're listening to this and you want that book and you have a defined visual voice, you have to put that in the contract. That maybe you don't get final say, but you need like, it's a partner deal. Like, because here's the deal. You're the one promoting it. Like, you're the one going out there and taking a couple of weeks off of work to travel around the country and to put it on your platforms and all that stuff. So it's something you have to stand behind, which is, I like fully stand behind my second and my third book. And my first book's incredible. The recipes are amazing, but like it doesn't look how I want it to look. And I would also say you have to interview all the agents and all the editors and find out who you want to work with, because someone who you think is cool and you want to be friends with them it's not always the best fit for you. So like for me, I really need someone to be like, Gabi, your writing, this is garbage. Like this is like, you need to like actually put some thought into this. And it's made me a much better businesswoman because I had that for the second two books. So is that specific?
That's absolutely perfect. And I think so important. I'll never forget. It actually didn't make it onto the podcast because it happened shortly after when we were walking back to the studio, but we had Deb Perlman on of Smitten Kitchen, and we kind of discussed that same thing. And she told me as we were leaving the studio a story that she was kind of asking Ina Garten for advice when she was doing her first book. And Ina had explained to her that she had this one situation in which she had a book deal and said very clearly that she wanted every recipe photographed, and they didn't want to do it. So she pulled the book and went to another agency. And the reason being is like, if your book doesn't do well or it is like a huge hit, it needs to be your vision either way, because the publisher's not going to work with you again if it does terribly. But at the same time, if it's not your vision and does terribly, you'll always wonder like, what would have happened if I actually had fought for what I want?
Right. And just have the wherewithal to know to ask for stuff like that. Like I thought it was a given. I had no idea. And I do think having a recipe for every image is so important. Like there's nothing that makes me sadder when I get a cookbook and there's like five photos in it. I'm like, okay, this can go on my bookshelf. It's a pretty spine, but I'm not going to cook from it.
And that happened with me because I shot my book a few weeks ago. And I remember in the conversations where my former editor, I've switched editors since, but he very much was like, well, we will probably get of the 100 recipes, 70 to 80 photos. And I said that was unacceptable. And I made sure that our photo shoot, like I spent 14 hour days making sure that every dish was ready so that even if we couldn't extend the shoot, like every photo was going to be taken.
That's incredible.
The key part is that I think it's the tie between both these stories is the concept of artistic vision, and that it's so it's so different from something like a social media platform or a blog where you really can have total control. And all of a sudden you're in this scenario in which there are other voices telling you what to do.
Right. And it's also on the blog, on social media, you can go back and edit things. But when you write a book, it's there. Like if you I've actually found a typo and I'm like, well, shit, now I have to wait for the fourth printing to fix it because they've already printed so many. But you know, you have to be so careful about all that kind of stuff and really think it through. And also, I think it's smart to not just jump into the first deal that comes to you, because there are many publishing companies who will offer you $5 for a cookbook. And let this be said, cookbooks are not money makers. Like, I have done 3 now and my advances have gotten bigger and bigger, but we actually spend more and more money on the book because I want to create an incredible product. But you have to, you shouldn't go into writing a book to make money. You should go into it. It's a piece of marketing material. Like, you want this to last forever. It's going to be in people's homes. You want it to be of service to people. So just have those kinds of things in your mind when you're going, you're not going to become a millionaire by writing cookbooks.
For sure. For sure. So I am currently going through your new book, Eat What You Want. It's so gorgeous. I mean, I think that was going to be a given no matter what.
Thank you.
But I love that it very much so feels like a Cali Girls just cookbook, and that's it. Down to your I see little gem salad with avocado, and just the visuals, the ideas, French onion grilled cheese. Tell me a little bit about how this book compares to your last and what kind of things you took away from the last experience that you put into this one.
So my second cookbook was such a pleasurable experience. I ended up signing with an editor who has turned into a dear friend of mine, but she also pushes me very hard. And she taught me so many things. She taught me the proper way to format all these recipes and all these different things. And I just think the difference between the second book and the third book really comes down to entertaining, because in the second book, I had no entertaining menus, no cocktails, nothing like that. It was just bomb recipes that I wanted to reflect my California girl life. This cookbook has a lot more. I mean, not that we can entertain right now anyways, but when we get out of quarantine, we're all going to have all the house parties. So it just has more of that community feel to it. And there are a lot more cocktails in it. And then recipe-wise, it's an extension of the second book. I have a very much global, California is a global melting pot that I take inspiration from and put my California spin on it. So I think this book has a little bit more of a global influence. And I took the recipes from the second book, the LARP and all that kind of stuff. And I expanded that into an entire chapter called When in Doubt Vacation, because I saw how much my audience was hungry for those global flavors, but in an approachable way without ingredients that were hard to track down. So I just took what I learned from the second book and put it into the third, along with cocktails.
Along with cocktails. Amazing. what would the next book be in terms of...
We just had that conversation. I was talking to my publishers last week and they're like, so what are you going to do for your fourth book? And I'm like, I don't know. I was like, let me sleep on it for 6 months and then let's talk about it.
Yeah. Oh, so let's actually touch on that briefly about what was the timeline for this book in terms of the recipe development, the shoot.
So most books, I would say, take 2 years start to finish. This book took us 18 months, so a year and a half, because originally we wanted it to come out fall 2020, but then we're like, oh shit, it's election year. There's going to be debates and all this stuff happening. I don't want to be on the road while everyone's, if I'll get bumped from every TV show if Correct. Someone does something dumb during election season. So we pushed it up 6 months. I still got the full year to write it, but my editing period was shortened and they had to rush print it. All of it doesn't even matter anymore because my book tour got canceled because of COVID. So I got bumped from all the shows anyways. But normally I would say you need 20 to 24 months to really put the work in, do the recipe development, edit, have a copy editor, like really get in there. It's a long process. So you have to think so long term in terms of what recipes are going to be relevant in 2 years when you start.
And how do you, how, what's your approach to kind of planning that far out, especially compared to a blog? And like anyone who works in digital food, the turnaround is so quick. Because you can just really jump on those, like anything that you see, that's of the moment. What is kind of your thought process when you're thinking that far out?
So I don't do much trendy food anyways. Like I'm just, that's never been my thing. Like I hated cupcakes 10 years ago when cupcakes were popular. I don't do this in any part of my life, like fashion trends, hair trends. Like it's just not who I am as a person. So I feel fortunate in the fact that I just try and make timeless, inspired recipes that are going to work for all the times, but that doesn't like, There's an omelet souffle in here that was inspired by those like cloud eggs or some whatever those were that everybody posted. And I was like, shit, I should have posted those. But I was like, it's too late now. Everybody else did it. But I just want recipes that are really going to work in people's kitchens, no matter how many kids you have, if you're single, if you're in a relationship, have a partner, whatever. So I keep that in my mind when developing recipes for something that's 2 years in the making.
Love it. Love it. Well, with that, that brings us into our lightning round, which is my favorite part of the podcast, where I'm just going to throw a few questions your way.
I'm ready. So
first would be, who's killing it on the gram? Who do you love to follow? It could be food people. It could be non-food people. Throw a few
Heather names. McMahon. Heather McMahon's my absolute favorite follow on Instagram. Do you follow her?
I do not. Tell me a little bit more.
She's a comedian. She's based in New York, but she's from Atlanta. She's quarantining in Atlanta, actually. And she just produces the most hot fire content. She's so freaking funny. I die for her. She's one of my favorite. Brad, have you been watching Brad Bucks with Brad and Gary Jannetty?
Yes. Oh, my God. I mean, well, like Gary Jannetty is just...
Love them.
Amazing.
Yeah, Gary's incredible. But their Brad Bucks gig is everything to me. Who else do I love following? Those are my top two favorites. Oh, and then Jamie Beck, who's a really dear friend of mine. She has nothing to do with the food world. She's an artist. She's in Provence, but she started this thing called Isolation Creation, and she's shooting something every day that she just forages in her like backyard, basically, and it's turned into this incredible project. People from all over the world are buying her prints, and I just think it's so nice to see someone taking the quarantine and like turning into something beautiful.
Amazing. That's great. What have been, I've never, like, I hate when I'm like, what's your favorite recipe you developed? But what are some kind of like highlights throughout the years that you look back and you're like, I always make this recipe because it is just amazing.
Yeah. My dad's kitchen sink cookies, which are in the new cookbook, are some of my favorite because my dad is the biggest sweet tooth of them all, only to be rivaled by my mother. Slutty brownies, near and dear to my heart. That was one of my first recipes to go viral. Basil vinaigrette, which is something I did a couple years ago that you will see on so many recipes I do because it's just the condiment of my choice besides ketchup. And the larb. I have a chicken larb in my second book, a salmon larb in my third book. I have a couple different, a beef larb on my website. I just love the flavor profiles from like a Thai larb dish.
Love it. So good. I mean, now I'm like very, very excited about these vinaigrettes. I also love the way that you shot the condiment section of
Thank you.
Full, the little kind of floods. Images that, yes, that floods the whole frame, which is, I think, such a nice way to do it.
Thank you.
What's exciting you in the food space right now? It could be an ingredient. It could be kind of like a place that you wanted to travel to before quarantine that you will go to when this is all over. It can be a technique, a recipe, anything.
Yeah, I have never been to Asia. So I'm just like enamored with all sorts of Asian cooking and techniques and flavor profiles. And I was planning on going this fall. I don't know if that'll still happen. But I just want to go and I want to eat all the things and learn all the different, you know, flavor combinations and cooking techniques. And so I feel like, and you see some of that in my my most recent book, I'm definitely having a moment. So that's what's on my mind. And like also tahini, but like tahini was really popular 3 years ago, but I still love it.
Yes. It still slaps. I love it. All right. And this is my favorite question. Every episode we play a game of fuck, marry, kill. But not with people, of course. So I picked some like beautiful, like Cali dishes, for you. So your options are, avocado toast, grain bowls, and fish tacos.
Okay, wait. Grain bowl, fish tacos. I'm writing these down because this is like a really intense question for me.
Yes.
Okay. I'm gonna kill the grain bowl.
Okay.
I'm gonna marry the avocado toast. No, I'm gonna marry the fish taco. No. Oh, that's so hard. Fuck the fish taco, marry the avocado toast, kill the grain bowl.
Amazing. Here we go. We love a challenge.
I mean, avocado toast is just never going to cheat on you, right? Never, like, it's never. So it's basic.
Always there. Always there in the morning, too. Yes. Yeah,
no, oh, yeah. That's it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Gabi. This was an incredible conversation. Thank you to everyone for listening. To learn more about the food and drink discovery platform that is the Feed Feed, head to thefeedfeed.com. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at the Feed Feed and myself at Jay Cohen and Gabi at What's Gabi Cooking. If you have a tip on who the next social media culinary star will be, send us a DM. We will see you next time.
The Feed Feed is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.